economic activity. U.S. sanctions target people, entities, officials, or even an entire country. There's no denying it. Some major economies are dumping the dollar or drawing down the reserves of the dollar. Actually, those are two separate issues, as our guests have indicated. Now, the countries we can mention here are China, Russia, and Iran, but what if the outcome of this is for the U.S. to actually threaten military action against them? Now, this was mentioned in an opinion piece written by Shannon Abraham. She said in order to avert a sudden dollar collapse, the U.S. has taken robust measures in the past to avoid this, and went as far as militarily, that is, threatening to attack or attacking other countries that are dumping the dollar. Some examples, the Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, or former President Saddam Hussein, announcing that Iraq would no longer sell its U.S. or its oil in the U.S. dollars. That's one example. We can take a look at Libya. In 2011, NATO to have attacked it in order to thwart the Libyan leader, Muammar Gaddafi, to create a gold-backed African currency in dinars, if you remember that. He also pushed African and Middle Eastern governments to dump the dollar. All right, our in-house guest joins us, Ahmad Salih, rejoins us for his final comments. We also have David Barkin, economist, also rejoining us. Okay, Ahmad, so the final question here, this theory that I just talked about, countries that are dumping the dollar from the trade where they want to eliminate the dollar, it seems like there is this relationship or connection being made that they are being targeted by the U.S. Militarily, perhaps, or that being actually the focus, Syria, Libya, Iraq, Iran being threatened by the U.S. on a number of occasions, and Russia and China also high on the radar of the U.S. Do you agree that in order to avert a sudden dollar collapse, the U.S. has taken these types of measures which involve militarily attacking the countries?
Yes, it's very interesting, and you came up with some examples. If you study the nuclear dossier of Iran, during the 12 months before these two sanctions being applied, there was no major incident happening on the ground in terms of the nuclear activities. If you go study in the history, you see that there is nothing done. Previously, when Iran was doing, for example, the 20% enrichment, there was a new sanction being applied by United Nations or Security Council. But the 12 months prior to the crippling sanctions of the central bank cut off from the SWIFT and the oil, there was absolutely no activity on the ground with regard to the nuclear dossier. But Ahmadinejad stepped into a very new dangerous path, and that was ditching the dollar, like the same as Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein did.
Let me turn our attention now to David. David, you heard our guest there, and you know, we're looking at the countries that are dumping the dollar at this point from the trade, and there's an association being made that they are being militarily perhaps targeted by the U.S., which in the past we can talk about Syria, Libya, and Iraq, all attacked by the U.S., of course, Libya through NATO. And then you have countries like Russia and China and Iran who are being threatened by the U.S. Do you think that there's a correlation there, that the U.S. actually targets these countries militarily?
I'm not sure that the United States' use of military force or the threat of military force against these countries that you mentioned is the result of these countries dumping the dollar per se, as much as these countries trying to develop their own internal development strategies, trying to develop a reasonable path for internal stability and well-being.
All right, David Barkin there. Unfortunately, we just don't have any more time to continue this discussion. I'm sure we're going to have you back, but thank you very much, Ahmad.
One point.
Sure. Go ahead.
About the JFK, I was talking about the Executive Order 11110. That was a very important executive order by U.S. President, and this order was empowering the U.S. Treasury to issue real notes. We were talking about issuing real dollar for the first time and for the last time in history, parallel to Federal Reserve. So he had a plan because, as you know, Federal Reserve is the only central bank which is a private entity.
Right, exactly.
So it was the
not many people know
Kennedy,
that, actually.
Yeah.
It's not common
It was the Kennedy's plan to take the power from the private sector of the so-called bankers or Illuminatis and to give it to the nation of the United States. We are talking about the government.
Thank you for that. Very insightful. We appreciate it. Ahmed Salehi, political economic thank analyst. Let me mention again your Twitter address, @AhmedSalehi_May, and also at Instagram, Ahmad.Salehi.official. Thank you for your contribution to the program.
Thank you, too.
The story of the dollar decline has been around for over a decade. There is no question that the decline is happening. As long as oil is pegged to the dollar will retain its strength in one way or another. But not so fast. The U.S. has single-handedly led itself down the path of the dollar decline. Massive spending, enormous printing of the dollar, well, those factors have accelerated the decline. And by weaponizing the dollar, many countries have shied away from it. By the way, COVID-19 may be the last straw. With a strong yuan, the dollar will literally have a run for the money. That does it for this edition of the program. Your questions and comments are always welcome. From Ikove Tagli and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. Please accept our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashemi Nejad about the master of the martyrs, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Stay tuned.
آیت الله العظمای خونساری علی الله مقامه از بازار تا مسجد سعید الله منزلشون 10 دقیقه راه بود اونجا وارد محراب.
The late Grand Ayatollah Khansari was one of the greatest ulama of Islamic history. He used to walk the distance between his house and the mosque where he was the imam. He was so pious that he changed his cloak and socks when in the mihrab of the mosque, so that no atom of impurity might be on his clothes when leading the salat of the Muslims. He lived for about 95 years and he was a true worshipper of Allah. With all the purity and sincerity that he had in his worship of Allah, once in the last moments of his life he told his son that he is leaving this world empty-handed.
4 تا عمل دست و پا شکسته داریم.
Now, sometimes we are proud of our actions and we think that we are the best worshippers of Allah. As you can see, the late Ayatollah Khansari claims that he has nothing fruitful in his hands regarding his prayers and worships. However, at the last moments of his life, he told his eldest son, I hope my attendance in the majalis of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam during the months of Muharram can help me on the day of resurrection and save my face over there. This is how the great men of Allah believe in Allah and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and I pray to Allah that the door of the majalis of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is not closed to our faces in our lives. Thank you very much, dear listeners of iRib English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashemi Nejad. To find out more about this program, please log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Pfizer has been accused of holding Brazil to ransom over demands to shield itself from possible vaccine side effect lawsuits in its contract to supply the country with 100 million COVID jabs. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Mata Busby and Flavia Milhorance. The piece is titled Pfizer Accused of Holding Brazil to Ransom Over Vaccine Contract Demands. The U.S. pharmaceutical company Pfizer has been accused of holding Brazil to ransom over demands to shield itself from possible vaccine side effect lawsuits in its contract to supply the country with 100 million COVID jabs. In its $1 billion deal with Pfizer Export BV, signed in March, despite its prior complaints, the Brazilian government agreed that a liability waiver be signed for any possible side effects of the vaccine, exempting Pfizer from any civil liability for serious side effects arising from the use of the vaccine, indefinitely. Indemnity from compensation claims has been common in contracts between many countries and big pharma companies since the late 1980s. The contract also stipulated that Brazil would cede to U.S. courts, convened secretly in the event of any contractual disputes relating to the vaccines. In April, the contract was leaked on the Health Ministry's website. A confidentiality agreement with Pfizer prevents the publication of its contracts. It was removed soon after and went largely unnoticed outside of Brazil, until the information was tweeted by a French lawyer and writer last month. Purchaser hereby agrees to indemnify, defend, and hold harmless Pfizer, BioNTech, and each of their affiliates from and against any and all lawsuits, claims, actions, demands, losses, damages, liabilities, settlements, penalties, fines, costs, and expenses caused by, arising out of, relating to, or resulting from the vaccine, reads the contract. Echoing AstraZeneca's acrimonious row with the European Union, the Brazilian government had previously complained about Pfizer's stipulation that if there is a delay in delivery, there is no penalty. But it agreed in the contract that while Pfizer would use commercially reasonable efforts to meet the delivery schedule, it would ultimately, under no circumstances, be subject to or liable for any late delivery penalties. The leak also revealed that Brazil agreed not to use the name, trade name, service marks, trade dress, or logos of Pfizer in publicity releases, advertising, or any other publication without its prior written consent in each instance. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism reported back in February that Pfizer had demanded that Brazil and Argentina put up sovereign assets as collateral to guarantee indemnity, as well as create a guarantee fund with money deposited in a foreign bank account. Pfizer said it had not interfered with any country's diplomatic, military, or culturally significant assets. Everyone already knows about Pfizer's clauses, said the then Brazilian Health Minister Eduardo Pazuello in January. I guess I don't need to repeat it, but I'll be succinct. Complete disclaimer for side effects from today to infinity. That simple. Brazilian courts of law waive any legal action on the company. That simple. In addition to Brazilian assets abroad available as collateral and long-term deposit for future actions abroad. The contract further reveals that Brazil elicited much cheaper jabs from Pfizer than the European Union, at about $10 a dose, while the pharmaceutical giant upped the number of doses it pledged to provide. Campaigners said Pfizer had exhibited behavior suggesting it was more interested in protecting its profits than safeguarding public health. Elena Ivanova, campaign's officer at Global Justice Now said Pfizer is all too happy to cash in on publicly funded coronavirus vaccines, but doesn't want to take on any of the risks. It's an all too familiar move from pharmaceutical companies that seem more interested in protecting their profits than protecting the health of the public. We can't keep putting our faith in private companies to provide life-saving medicines only to see them hold counties to ransom. As required by domestic law, the government released online all vaccine acquisition contracts, except those from Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer, due to the confidentiality clauses. Pfizer has been credited with saving untold lives with its vaccine, but has also faced criticism for the disparity of its rollout after it prioritized higher-priced sales in richer countries. Arthur Rolo, the former National Consumer Secretary at Brazil's Justice Ministry, said it was absolutely questionable to keep an administrative contract confidential. Arthur Rolo added, "The public administration has a duty of transparency, even more in times when there is suspicion of embezzlement in the purchase of vaccines." To the extent that Janssen, Johnson & Johnson's subsidiary, and Pfizer say their contracts are standardized, it doesn't seem reasonable to require this secrecy clause because you can't compare whether the contract is the same or not in other countries. French lawyer and writer Juan Branco, who posted the contract on Twitter, said that since the production cost of a Pfizer vaccine is believed to be a maximum of $2, the legitimacy of the profits should be questioned. "This debate can't happen if the public and the citizens are kept out of the loop," he added. Pfizer's COVID vaccine sales brought in $3.5 billion in the first 3 months of this year, nearly a quarter of its total revenue. Pfizer-BioNTech aims to produce 3 billion doses by the end of this year and 4 billion by 2022. Analysts have forecast revenue of over $6.6 billion for the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine shot in 2023, according to the Reuters news agency, mostly from booster vaccine shots. Last month, Brazil said it would begin to give booster shots of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine to immunosuppressed or vulnerable people and over 80s. Meanwhile, the company said they had signed a deal with Brazil's Eurofarma Laboratorios SA to manufacture their vaccine for distribution within Latin America. It marks a turnaround for the Brazilian government. Last year, the far-right president, Jair Bolsonaro, who had been openly dismissive of Pfizer's proposals, sarcastically claimed that vaccines could turn recipients into alligators, and officials in his government called the company's demands abusive. Brazil's Congress has launched an inquiry into the Brazilian government's response to the coronavirus pandemic and sluggish vaccine rollout. Those leading the investigation believe Jair Bolsonaro's administration was negligent in not buying vaccines in 2020 while pushing ineffective drugs such as chloroquine, and that lives could have been saved had the Brazilian government acted earlier. At a televised congressional inquiry in May, Pfizer's Latin America president, Carlos Murillo, said indemnity clauses were operative in more than 110 countries and rejected claims the company had been exploitative. In this pandemic, Pfizer is an unprecedented situation, wanted everyone to collaborate with this process. For this reason, it defined the same conditions for all countries as it did for Brazil, he said. Pfizer spokesperson Sharon Castillo said the indemnification clauses were common in public health emergencies. In the context of bilateral negotiations, Pfizer and BioNTech have no intention of interfering with any country's diplomatic, military, or culturally significant assets, and any suggestion to the contrary is misleading and factually incorrect, she said.
wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The coronavirus pandemic has not only cost countless lives, but has hit the world economy hard. The United States, which has the world's biggest economy, hasn't been an exception. The U.S. is the world's worst-hit nation by the pandemic. Under former President Donald Trump, the country launched a program called Operation Warp Speed to facilitate and accelerate the production and distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. U.S. pharmaceutical companies developed several vaccines and rolled them out to the country's population. Trump's successor, Joe Biden's administration, set a target of vaccinating 70% of the country's population, at least partially, by the 4th of July. However, the country met the target a month later, despite generous incentives given to Americans.
So at least 40% of the U.S. population is a victim of a lot of silly conspiracy theories about the vaccine and are adamant about not taking the vaccine. It's a big problem in the U.S. that's been stoked by social media and QAnon and, you know, career right-wing politicians who are manipulating it all for their personal gain. So the U.S. Is confronting with this real problem.
The vaccination program proved effective at bringing down the daily COVID cases and deaths, but up to a certain point. The highly infectious Delta variant of the coronavirus sent a new wave of cases and fatalities across the world. Scrambling to contain the spiraling outbreak, President Biden announced new mandatory vaccination plans on Thursday.
I will sign an executive order that will now require all executive branch federal employees to be vaccinated. All. I've signed another executive order that will require federal contractors to do the same. If you want to work with the federal government and do business with us, get vaccinated.
But in addition to saving lives, the U.S. government is aiming at saving the economy, too.
Well, it certainly would help because we have a problem going on of a lot of workers not wanting to go back to work now that the COVID Delta variant is accelerating in a lot of places in the country. That was obvious in the last month's job report.
The mandatory vaccination program has triggered a backlash from American conservatives. Hours after the Democratic U.S. president announced a coronavirus vaccine mandate for federal workers, Republicans lambasted the decision, suggesting that it's unconstitutional. Figures, including Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel, threatened to take legal action against the Biden administration. A majority of the critics are questioning the administration's authority to declare such a mandate. Back in March, the Democrats in the U.S. Congress passed a bill for a $1.9 trillion coronavirus stimulus package without a single vote from Republican lawmakers. The plan was intended to send direct payments of up to $1,400 per person to the majority of American households, extend a $300 per week unemployment insurance supplement, and put funds into vaccine distribution. The Republicans argued that the package was superfluous as the economy was reopening anyway. They believed the economy would suffer down the road, considering how big a figure the bill earmarked.
Well, you know, that's a false argument. What the Republicans are really about is that they don't want to spend on these stimulus programs because if these stimulus programs spending amounts to significant fiscal stimulus, then they'll have to raise taxes on corporations and investors, which means they'll have to reduce some of the generous Trump tax cuts of 2017. that gave $4.5 trillion in tax cuts to corporations and wealthy individuals and investors, they would have to raise taxes. And that's really what it's about. They don't want to raise those taxes. They don't want to take away Trump tax cuts if they got to have to spend a lot on social programs.
With the United States COVID-19 figures rising in recent weeks, economic indicators are expected to be negatively impacted. Biden's unprecedented and aggressive move to make vaccines mandatory for a considerable portion of the American society can highlight the gravity of the risk the U.S. economy is currently facing from the deadly contagion.
Israel is stepping up its hawkish warmongering rhetoric against Iran. The chief of staff of Israel's military has said the regime is putting more extensive plans in place for when it decides to, quote, attack Iran. Aviv Kohavi claims the regime has, quote, greatly accelerated preparations for action against Iran's nuclear program. He says a considerable increase in the budget has been allocated to that purpose, with more intelligence and operational capabilities assigned. Kohavi also said Israeli military's current main objective is to stem what he called Iran's presence in the Middle East, with an emphasis on Syria and elsewhere. Those operations are taking place all over the Middle East, against Hamas in Palestine, against Hezbollah in Lebanon. Earlier this month, Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said in an interview that the regime was prepared to attack Iran, saying that, quote, we are at a point where we need to take military action against Iran. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has implicitly acknowledged that the regime has carried out covert attacks on Iran's peaceful nuclear program and brazenly said that the regime would keep on with such attacks.
And the reason behind its stepped-up hostility toward Iran and a very open hostility is that Israel seeks to be the lone superpower, you could say mini superpower of the region, as a junior partner of the big superpower, the United States.
Iran has already condemned Tel Aviv's reckless rhetoric against Tehran. Late last month, the Iranian envoy to the United Nations warned Israel against any adventurism toward the Islamic Republic. In a letter to the President of the United Nations Security Council, Zahra Ershadi, the Deputy Permanent Representative of Iran to the UN, warned the regime against carrying out its threats of attacking Iran over its peaceful nuclear program. Unchecked, such continued unlawful acts and systematic provocative measures, with all their serious ramifications, would undoubtedly further destabilize the region and also endanger international peace and security.
It was not just when Netanyahu, with all of his ridiculousness, his cartoonish presentations and so forth, his obsession with Iran's development, it's the whole establishment, the whole Israeli establishment that has this extreme hostility toward Iran and wants to continue to take action in the hopes of provoking something.
Being Naftali Bennett's visit to the United States last week, Tel Aviv and Washington agreed to form a high-level team to tackle the Iran nuclear issue. Israel's threats against Iran are believed to be aimed at influencing stalled nuclear talks between Tehran and other world powers.
Well, Israel definitely wants to prevent any possibility of success for the a return to the JCPOA, the so-called nuclear deal. And so it's moving in this direction.
However, analysts believe Washington's options outside of diplomacy with Iran are limited.
military option would be unacceptable to the top Pentagon brass, who have engaged in enough war games and other scenarios to recognize that there is no workable military solution. It is believed that Israel presumably recognizes that a military option would also be counterproductive.
The United States marked the 20th anniversary of the September 11 terrorist attacks. The world will probably never forget that fateful day in 2001, which changed the course of history. U.S. investigators said the Al-Qaeda terror group was behind the whole thing. America said it had evidence showing that the attacks were planned and led from inside Afghanistan. This triggered the invasion of Afghanistan that bogged down the U.S. military for 20 years. Two decades later, the family members of 9/11 victims are still struggling to find answers. They have long been pursuing accountability from another country, Saudi Arabia. Most of the hijackers who carried out the attacks were Saudi nationals. That is not all that ties the kingdom to the complicated plot. Long classified documents have revealed that some of the hijackers had been in contact and received support from individuals connected to the Saudi government. They also show that the phone number of then Saudi ambassador to the U.S., Prince Bandar bin Sultan, was in the phone book of a close associate of Al-Qaeda founder Osama bin Laden. The families of victims said in a statement last month that evidence implicates Saudi government officials in supporting the attacks. The families have long argued that Saudis had advanced knowledge of the plot but did nothing to stop it. The families of the victims have been pushing for the release of more 9/11 documents that successive U.S. administrations have kept secret. Biden has made up his mind about the upcoming anniversary. He will visit all three sites where hijacked planes crashed 20 years ago to commemorate the victims. But will his administration give the victim families what they've been demanding so long? They want to know for certain if Saudi Arabia aided the hijackers. Some of the still secret files relate to an FBI investigation known as Operation Encore, that focused on the two hijackers who lived in San Diego and individuals who may have assisted them. A former FBI agent who was involved in the investigation has said that he is confident that the two hijackers had a U.S.-based support network. Riyadh still denies any involvement in the 9/11 plot. It is now fighting a lawsuit brought by the families in federal court in New York. Why have successive U.S. governments been reluctant to release the files so many years after the horrific event?
It has been a mystery why the U.S. has been covering up for connections to Saudi Arabia throughout these last 20 years. So that's why the 9/11 families have had their lawsuit and tried through the courts to get access to this information. But, you know, it's not just the 9/11 families. The entire public of the United States deserves to know what happened on 9/11 and before 9/11, deserves to know what connections the U.S. has been covering up for.
U.S. authorities have argued that any release of more files could result in damage to the national security. But some observers believe Saudi lobbies in America could have played a role in blocking the very long-awaited release. Top U.S. officials also seem reluctant to sour lucrative ties between America and the autocratic kingdom by thoroughly investigating the clues about possible Saudi government involvement in 9/11 events.
The close relationship that the U.S. government has with Saudi Arabia has made it very difficult for the 9/11 families to get the access to the information they deserve and they need to prosecute the case that has been going on for 20 years against the 9/11 hijackers.
Will the Biden administration, which has promised more transparency, act differently?
The Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan in a matter of weeks and seized control of the capital, Kabul, without facing much resistance from the U.S.-trained Afghan security forces, as foreign troops and citizens were scrambling to leave the country before a deadline set by U.S. President Joe Biden. The security situation at the international Kabul airport deteriorated to the point where U.S. intelligence agencies warned about an extreme risk to people present at or in the vicinity of the airport. On August 26th, a bomb attack hit the crowds outside the airport, killing over 180 people, including 13 U.S. military personnel. The attack was claimed by an offshoot of the Daesh terror group called Daesh-K. The Taliban said the attack took place in an area that was supposed to be secured by the U.S. troops. The group also blamed the U.S. and the hurried evacuations for the incident, saying there wouldn't be any bomb attack if the situation were calmer. Daesh-K has fought both foreign forces and the Taliban in Afghanistan since its formation in 2015. The Taliban now say they don't need international help to uproot the terrorists.
The U.S. has been 20 years in Afghanistan, has accomplished nothing good. The Taliban doesn't want U.S. involved anymore, but the fact that a country doesn't want U.S. involvement doesn't mean the U.S. will not be involved. Let's hope that this is ending, but that remains to be seen.
Army General Mark Milley, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, had earlier floated the possibility of coordinating strikes against Daesh with the Taliban. The United States has no longer any army troops on the ground in Afghanistan, nor any air bases near the country. Washington, however, has pledged to continue what it calls fighting terrorism in the Central Asian country. The only way for the U.S. to carry out strikes on Afghanistan is by deploying its aircraft carriers. The U.S. is reportedly considering keeping its aircraft carriers in the region, including in the Arabian Sea, to continue its operations there. But that requires new calls for funds and creates some technical obstacles, including intelligence collection over such long distances. It also means that President Biden's claim about wanting to end America's endless wars is somewhat misleading. In the meantime, some U.S. politicians are expecting troops back on Afghanistan's soil.
We will be going back into Afghanistan as we went back into Iraq and Syria.
Are you seriously think the United States will once again, in a foreseeable future,
yes,
put troops back into Afghanistan?
We'll have to, because the threat will be so large.
But while even some of Washington's NATO allies have expressed their dissatisfaction with the outcome of the 20-year-long war, how is going back to Afghanistan feasible for the United States?
Lindsey Graham, of course, is very anxious to have more wars. He's heavily financed in his campaigns by military contracts to the U.S. In the 2020 election cycle, they donated nearly $400,000 to his campaign. So he has, and this is not new in 2020, he has often said how much he supports rebuilding the military, as he calls it, in order to protect U.S. freedoms.
The fact that the Taliban came to power even before the foreign troops left Afghanistan's soil shows that the West's military intervention in the country can never succeed.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن می‌کند.
Be aware. The hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Dear brothers and sisters, you are listening to The Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio. In this special episode, we select a short part of Imam Khomeini's will. We take pride, and our noble and thoroughly committed nation is proud in being the followers of a school of thought which intend to dig out the Quranic truth, which commit themselves thoroughly to the unity of Muslim and even humanity from the graveyards and utilize it as the greatest perception for the disentanglement of man from all shackles on his limbs and on his mind and souls, which are leading him towards destruction, slavery, and servitude to the oppressors.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And you are listening to Spring of Truth coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So stay tuned with us. I am your host, Abdullah Al-Musawi, an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qom. We are looking at Imam Khomeini's point of view when it comes to Ashura. Imam Al-Khomeini was quoted saying, "A person who appears sad, whose face shows his affliction by tears, is actually helping to preserve the uprising and the movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam." With Imam al-Hussein salamullah alayhi, one of the dimensions and one of the reasons we cry for him, because we want to honor the Imam, glorify the Imam, give more focus and attention to his position and personality, that through him Islam is preserved. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa ala, he said, "He who dies and no one mourns him, there is no honor in him."
When your horse returns to Alcamp riderless, and your son and I emerge out sorrowful, when your horse returns to Alcamp riderless, and your son and I emerge out sorrowful. Why did you leave us to fend for ourselves? Hussein, Hussein, the slain martyr.
Even Allah in the Quran, he says, when he talks about the Jews, he said, "فَمَا بَكَتْ عَلَيْهِمُ السَّمَاءُ وَالْأَرْضُ," nor the earth, nor the sky cried for them. Meaning what? Meaning they had no value. They weren't valuable people. If they had value, then earth and the sky would cry for them. We understand from this ayah as well that for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the heavens and the earth wept for him because he was the guardian of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on earth. So me and you, when we establish these morning ceremonies for Imam al-Hussein, peace be upon him, we're trying to show the world his unique and exceptional personality, that people through this act, they could come and get to know him a little bit more. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
In a new report authored by the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, it has been found that the federal government has spent $21 trillion on war and militarization both inside the U.S. and around the world over the past 20 years. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Lindsay Kashagarian Ryder. This article is published under the heading, U.S. spent $21 trillion on war and militarization since 9/11. Stay tuned for more. Years have now passed since 9/11. The 20 years since those terrible attacks have been marked by endless wars, harsh immigration crackdowns, and expanded federal law enforcement powers that have cost Americans their privacy and targeted entire communities based on nothing more than race, religion, or ethnicity. Those policies have also come at a tremendous monetary cost and a dangerous neglect of domestic investment. In a new report authored by the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, it has been found that the federal government has spent $21 trillion on war and militarization both inside the U.S. and around the world over the past 20 years. That's roughly the size of the entire U.S. economy. Even while politicians have written blank checks for militarism year after year, they have said Americans can't afford to address the most urgent issues. No wonder these past 20 years have been rough on U.S. families and communities. After strong growth from 1970 to 2000, household incomes have stagnated for 20 years as Americans struggled through two recessions in the years leading up to the pandemic. As pandemic eviction moratoriums end, millions are at risk of homelessness. U.S. public health systems have also been chronically underfunded, leaving the U.S. helpless to enact the testing, tracing, and quarantining that help other countries limit the pandemic's damage. Over 650,000 Americans have died from COVID-19, the equivalent of 9/11 every day for over 7 months. The opioid epidemic claims another 50,000 lives a year. Meanwhile, extreme weather events like wildfires, hurricanes, and floods have grown in frequency over the past 20 years. The U.S. hasn't invested nearly enough in either renewable energy or climate resiliency to deal with the increasing effects climate change has on American communities. In the face of all this suffering, it's clear that $21 trillion in spending hasn't made Americans any safer. Instead, the human costs have been staggering. Around the world, the forever wars have cost 900,000 lives and left 38 million homeless. And as the disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan has shown us, they were a massive failure. U.S. militarized spending has helped deport 5 million people over the past 20 years, often taking parents from their children. The majority of those deported hadn't committed any crime except for being in the U.S., and it has paid for the government to listen in on the phone calls and target communities for harassment and surveillance without any evidence of crime or wrongdoing, eroding the civil liberties of all Americans. There is a silver lining. It has been found that for just a fraction of what the United States has spent on militarization these last 20 years, they could start to make life much better. For $4.5 trillion, they could build a renewable, upgraded energy grid for the whole country. For $2.3 trillion, they could create 5 million $15 an hour jobs with benefits for 10 years. For just $25 billion, they could vaccinate low-income countries against COVID-19, saving lives and stopping the march of new and more threatening virus variants. They could do all that and more for less than half of what they have spent on wars and militarization in the last 20 years. With communities across the U.S. in dire need of investment, the case for avoiding more pointless deadly wars couldn't be clearer.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle.